I was the name in the program that had everyone scratching their heads. Everyone who didn't recognize it is scratching their heads going, who is this person on the program? Everyone who recognized my name is scratching their heads going, why is he on the program? After 21 years of what I call vocational ministry, I do not like the term full-time ministry. Last time I checked, the Great Commission said nothing about whether you got a paycheck for it or not. I believe we're all full-time Christian ministers, but some of you draw a paycheck from a church. I no longer do that. After 20 years, it seemed apparent that the Lord was moving us to work in industry as far as vocation. And we as a family then had three choices that we had to work out. One was church. It was apparent that at that time, it was necessary that we move our home church. Because I had students over the years from several churches, we had picked three churches that we intended to visit. And we visited the first church. We never did get to the other two. It was very clear to us that the Lord wanted us at the ministry that we're now in Northampton, Pennsylvania. We then had to deal with the second problem, children. How are we going to educate the two that are still not yet to college age? And we decided to make a decision there to homeschool. That is why this may be the last picture of my wife smiling. Because we now homeschool our two younger children. Our oldest is in college. But we had to deal with that issue. And a third issue was ministry. If we're not a vocational minister any longer, what are we going to do as far as our ministry for the Lord outside of our local church? How can we impact other local churches and impact the world for the gospel? We actually have gone two directions here. One, we feel that every hobby could be a ministry opportunity. Now, we all say that on the surface. But how do you make a hobby of history and Civil War history a ministry opportunity? We found a way. And we portray Amos and Emily Billingsley. Amos was a chaplain in the 101st Pennsylvania Volunteer Infantry, and we are Civil War reenactors, go to reenactments and portray Amos and Emily. And sometimes in churches, we'll be in a church next weekend doing old-fashioned Sunday. It's 200th anniversary of the town, and so the chairman of the deacon board of the fundamental church in that town is also on the planning committee for the bicentennial celebration. And he said, oh, I know someone who can actually come and preach in first person. Why don't we do that? And they said, oh, great, we'll have the ministerium get together and do that. And they went, no. Our church will sponsor it. We'll take care of it. So we'll be doing that this weekend. And so we go out also at actual Civil War encampments and participate in Sunday services. And actually, during reenactments, give first aid for modern first aid that is sometimes necessary. My bunkmate is a retired MD. The other area is that of creation. And using our expertise over the years, what we have been able to come up with as far as expertise, to try to help others on this particular issue. What I'm going to present is actually was begun by Dr. Harris. He came to me and said, I have an idea. I'd like you to take a series of Wednesday evening services and see if you can educate folk on creation and evolution. Because you know what? There are a lot of men out there, some of whom we would agree with on a number of issues, but we're uncomfortable having in our church. But primarily their ministry is to bash evolution in a public forum in a large debate hall with a college professor. Well, who comes to your adult Sunday school class and teaches your adult how to witness to someone when they have a question about creation? Who teaches your teens what's the difference between really creationistic thinking and intelligent design? Isn't that the same as evolution? That's what the court said. Oh, well, intelligent design, that's creationism in disguise. Oh, no. We would say it's really evolution. But see, very few people understand the difference between creationism, intelligent design, and evolution. See, we would almost equate intelligent design with evolution. The world equates it with creation. Can your students in your school explain the difference to me? So what we confronted with ourselves was, how are we going to educate kids in our schools, in our churches. So I went back and I thought, and I got out my pen and I scribbled down some ideas. I came back to Dr. Harris and said, I think I can do it in 12 sessions. To which he responded, well, I was thinking 4. So I went back to my lab and took some free time, redid some things, scheduled some things out, moved this idea over here, rescheduled, and I came back and said, I think I can do it in 6 sessions. To which he said, well, I was thinking maybe 4. The relationship there was, at that point in time, employee-employer, I did 4. I'm offering you 12, if you have the time. Actually, what we've tried to do is come up with a way that we can very simply help people understand these issues. I am not a preacher. Okay? I made a deal, if you will, with Dr. Harris when I first went to Bethel that I would not try to preach in the science lab if he would not try to teach science from the pulpit. It worked very, very well. Okay, I'm not a preacher, and you're going to know that very, very quickly. You probably had suspicions 2 sentences in that I was not a preacher. But I think I can have the ability to take something that's very complex and boil it down to a point where students and people that are non-scientists can understand it. So I usually start out with a discussion of a theme verse. When I go into a church, I try to hit them with the theme from 1 Peter 3:15 that we are to be able to give a reason of the hope that is in us. Can we sit down with someone who has a question about creation, not to turn them from an evolutionist to a creationist, but can we give them a good, scientifically sound answer as to what we believe and why we believe it and a reason of the hope that is in us? Our teenagers have to learn, for instance, that they are weird. Now, you didn't have any question about me on that account. But teenagers get defensive. What do you mean I'm weird? Biblical Christianity, only religion in the face of the world over all time that said, you know you're going to heaven. Everybody else is working their way to heaven in one form or another. But we say we know for certain. Why? If I ask you for a biblical reason why you knew you were going to heaven, I dare say everyone in the room could start quoting verses. Okay. But what if the Bible might be wrong on the subject of creation? See, if the Bible might be wrong about creation, it might be wrong about salvation. See, if you have doubts, I'm not saying you disbelieve Genesis 1. If you allow the possibility that Genesis 1 may not be totally accurate, what's that do to John 3? 1 John 1? Romans 6? Pick any chapter you want. When I get to the point that I start doubting sections of the Scripture, I have now changed the topic. Now I have to answer the question, this is the Word of God? Or it contains the Word of God. Very big difference. Either I defend the entire book, or the entire book's a question mark. Now I don't know for sure whether I'm going to heaven. And we need to impact our students and our children in our Sunday schools, in our youth ministries, with that understanding. Now, for clarity, we do have to define some terms. Science. What's science? Well, you know, if you've done any curriculum work with your Christian school, you've found that every book, especially from our Christian authors, has a different definition of science. And some of them sound really cool. I tried to boil it down because at the time I was responsible for K through 12 at our school, and I didn't want them learning a different definition every year. So we had an easy, simple 3-point definition. Science is, number 1, observation. I've got to be able to observe it, touch it, maybe measure it if it's something that I can't. What temperature is that? My wife and I will give you different responses. One person defined marriage as someone who is always cold, committing to spend the rest of their life with someone who is always hot. I don't know if that's true for all couples, but it is true for us. For Father's Day, my wife gave me a card that says, honey, you're the coolest. And then you open it up, it says, because you keep the thermostat at 65 degrees. But I have to be able to observe it or measure it in some way. 2, it is a system for making the observations. I have to observe things following certain rules of science. And if you don't understand those rules, a lot of things that the evolutionist puts out makes certain level of sense until you begin to examine what rules they've broken in the process of coming up with their conclusion. Third, I've got to organize those into some usable form. If I'm in my lab and I come up with some tremendous new discovery of some drug that wipes out all known forms of intestinal cancer, but I don't tell anybody, what good is that? I have to take my observations and organize them into a paper that can be presented at a conference and other scientists can verify that. And we can come up with a conclusion that predicts the future of what will happen if we give this to certain patients. I've got to organize it. A periodic chart hanging on the wall of a classroom. It's organized observations. A physics formula. Organized observations. But see, it's at that step where our finite minds begin to alter what we've actually seen to what we predict. There is a difference between the observations, the science, and the conclusions we draw from it. See, and we all come into scientific endeavor with biases. Our students have to understand that creationists and evolutionists think differently. See, creationism, and for my definition, I use the Creation Research Society as a good, common definition, accepted definition of what creationism is. Creationism says, basically, that the account in Genesis is historic truth. There really was a flood. Now, we can't call it a flood in science. Scientists have to use big words. Okay, it's part of being in the union. Okay? You have to have big words. And I always used to, and I have former students sitting here. I'm not going to call on her. Okay? Her initials are Janelle Franklin. But I'm not going to call on her or embarrass her in any way. But she will probably back me up on this. I always used to tell the students, here's the big word to slip into conversation tonight at dinner. Because when you use big words, everybody wins. See, if you throw out the big word at dinner, Mom is happy because you've learned something. You're happy because Mom stops asking questions. Because she doesn't want to admit she doesn't know what you said. Okay? Now when Mom writes the big check to the principal because she's happy that the children have learned, the principal is happy. The principal then tells me, the teacher, oh, Mrs. So-and-so wrote a wonderful letter with her tuition check thanking you for what her children... Now I'm happy. See, everybody wins. So we don't call it Noah's flood. Okay, it's the Noachian deluge. Okay, so file that away. Bring it up at the Outback tonight when you're having dinner, and you will be the envy of all the people around you. Evolution. For evolution, I use a definition from Julian Huxley. I use this one because it's consistent, it's scientifically sound. Huxley said evolution is a one-way process, irreversible in time, producing apparent variety, leading to higher degrees of organization, more differentiated, more complex, but at the same time, more integrated. Okay, that works. That's a real good science definition. It's loaded with big words, right? Let's simplify it for teenagers. Okay? For those of you that aren't teenagers, pretend you are. Okay? And Dr. Henson at Bob Jones University had a perfect definition. A tank of hydrogen, given sufficient time, becomes people. That is really a good definition. To be honest with you, you know, people always talk about, well, evolution says man came from a monkey or man came from an amoeba. No! That's biological evolution. Frankly, folks, that's the easy part. You've got to evolve carbon before you can make anything out of it. You've got to evolve oxygen atoms. I brought that up in the lab one time and people looked at me dumbfounded. I never considered such a thing. How do you evolve platinum? You know, we make fun of the alchemists in history class who thought they could turn lead to gold. Oh, those people are idiots. But you think you can change hydrogen to people? That's good solid science. I don't know about you. I have a disconnect there. Somehow that doesn't make sense. So now what we do with the students is say, okay, now let's compare these. These are two different ways of looking at the world. But you have to understand, neither one of them is observable. That's one of the rules of science. See, anything before man's on the scene in evolutionary thinking, or anything before day six of creation from creationistic thinking, can't be science. Neither one is repeatable. You can't do it again. So what you have are two competing religious positions. And what you have to ask yourselves is which one makes more sense with the data that we see. So how do evolutionists think and how do creationists think? Evolutionists think that everything occurs in a natural process. Okay, that is, it's self-directed. Everything in the world works all by itself. Okay? Creationists believe everything gets here by a supernatural process. There's some external force that drives the universe. We would call him our Heavenly Father. Not all creationists are fundamental Baptists. There are other religions that hold to creationistic thinking, but they have one thing in common. There's an external force. And we make that decision going in. For instance, one evolutionary author put it this way. And I'm sorry, I can't read from this angle. Well, maybe I can. I'll lean forward. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, we are forced by our a priori adherence to natural causes. In other words, they've already made up their mind ahead of time. It was all done by itself. We've already made up our minds ahead of time. It was done by God. We have two different ways of looking at the same data. So one person looks at the world and says, this is amazing. There was this big bang and all this stuff came. This is really, really cool. Somebody else looks at it and says, man, this is perfect. It's designed just absolutely everything works great. Somebody must have really thought this through ahead of time. See, we have two diametrically opposed ways of thinking. And they're not going to be interrelated. They can't be. As much as the liberal theologians try, you can't do it. It's two different thinking methods. Example. When I was in college, I went by the plan that maybe some of you used. I squeezed 4 years into five. Basically, went 2 years to school, got a real nice letter from the business office. If you think you might actually pay your bill next year, come back. Otherwise, make other arrangements. It was polite, but basically that's what it said. So I took a year off and I was working. During that year, I had a car accident. I was sitting at a red light, Pastor Deer, Roosevelt Boulevard. Sitting at a red light, 6:30 in the morning. Car behind me apparently didn't see the red light because he hit the back of me going 45 some odd miles an hour. Okay? Now, we have a family meeting. Have you had those? Family meeting. My mother took observations. You drive 40 miles one way to work, which at the time you were happy to have a job, you drove the 40 miles. You spend a lot of time in your car. You're out 3-4 nights a week with church orchestra practice, you know, with, you know, boys brigade, which my church had. Conclusion. You need a nice little car that's good on gas. Whether or not you agree with the conclusion, is it logical from the data? Yes. I looked at the same data. I'm driving like 40 miles each way to work. I spend a lot of time in my car. I'm out like 3-4 nights a week for church and ministry things. I need a big car so I'm comfortable. You know, I got a lot of caloric reserve here. I need room. Again, whether or not you agree with my conclusion, is it logical from the data? See, both of these positions are logical from the data. We had different mindsets coming in looking at it. That's what happens in science. Creationists and evolutionists think differently. Evolutionists believe everything works by random processes. Just randomly things change. Creationists say, no, there is a direction. There's a purpose behind what we see in the world. For instance, the scriptures tell us the Lord by wisdom hath founded the earth. By understanding he established the heavens. See, there was a thought process there. But the evolutionist says, no, there's just random change, and things are constantly changing, and the good stuff wins, and the bad stuff loses. Evolution, and now this is another juicy word you can throw in tonight, they believe in uniformitarianism. Creationists believe in catastrophism. Uniformitarianism refers to the rate at which these changes are taking place. Everything's constantly changing, but at the same rate of speed. Creationists say, no, 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 no. There's been big changes in the earth. For instance, if you want a good definition of uniformitarian thinking, look to Peter. Peter tells us in the last days, knowing this first, that there shall come scoffers saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. That's uniformitarianism. That's an excellent definition. When he describes the end days, he's describing most science classrooms in the United States today. So in most science classrooms, you go in or you take the little trip to Luray Caverns. Okay? You get the little college student who has memorized their little spiel. So they go over here and says, you will look at the following formation, you will see a collection of stalagmites and stalactites. T for top, that's how you keep them straight. As water has dripped through this particular canyon down into this cave, it is carrying large amounts of limestone and calcium carbonate deposits. We've been able to calculate the rate at which calcium is deposited at the ends of these stalactites. Knowing the size here, we have been able to figure out that it's umpteen million years old. True! If water always dripped through that cave at that rate of speed. But what if there was a flood? Now, it would have to be a big flood. One that covered the highest mountains by, 15 cubits, just to pick a number out of the air. Now, when that water dripped through that cave, could I build that in a hurry? See, we believe there have been two major catastrophes in Earth's history. The fall of man and the Noachian deluge, the flood. Both of which had catastrophic effects on the Earth and threw out all these little time clocks. And so we would go into a school or a church and we would explain this so the students have an understanding of what's going on and how they think differently than the evolutionist people. Evolution, for instance, believes that everything is irreversible. Remember Huxley's definition? Irreversible in time? Guess what? On that we agree. Creationists also think all processes in the world are universal. And they are irreversible. We differ in that evolutionists think everything is going up. Creationists think everything is going down. See, if you start out with a perfect world, what's the only effect sin could have? Downward. Even evolutionists will admit there are no known violations of the second law of thermodynamics, something I would expand and take 40 minutes on, but my wife wants to go to dinner at a reasonable hour this evening, so we will not pursue that. However, the scriptures tell us, Thou, Lord, in the beginning hast laid the foundations of the earth. The heavens are the work of thine hands. They shall perish. But thou remainest. They shall wax old as doth a garment, and as a vesture thou shalt fold them up, and they shall be. In other words, the world is going to be what we do with our clothes. We throw them up, we get them all in a big bag, and what do? We send them off to the Goodwill. Or, in our case, we send our cast-offs to who? To the missionaries. I have a problem with that philosophically. Where's Mr. Gingrey? Philosophically, I have a problem with sending our cast-offs to the missionaries. But that's what we do. We get rid of old things. The earth is the same way. And God's going to fold it up and it's going to be gone. Everything goes irreversibly downward. Creationists and evolutionists deal with something called mechanism and vitalism. Now, this is deep, okay? So you got to put on your thinking caps with me. Mechanism is a philosophy of biology that says that you are basically a sum total of biochemical processes that we happen to define as being alive. Creationists are vitalistic. We say, no, there's something inherently different between living matter and non-living matter. And man specifically, somehow different than other living things, in a way that you cannot measure in science. There's a spiritual aspect. Do you see the impact of raising generations of children in mechanistic philosophy? See, if you're just a group of biological processes undergoing certain chemical reactions that we define as life, and inside your little sack of chemicals, there's another small sack of chemicals, is there any real problem with aborting the smaller sack? Do you see how the things that we face on a social level are an actual outcropping of the philosophy we have built into students? We've taught them to think mechanistically, then they behave mechanistically. To which I could never understand my evolutionary counterparts in the classroom complaining about how the children were acting like animals. Well, yesterday you told them they were. What's the shock? But see, if I bring up people in a vitalistic philosophy, it is reflected in how they deal socially and how they deal with issues. Evolution is a continuing process. Everything in the world continues on. We would say, no, it's a completed process. It's done. Because last I checked, God, the Creator, said the heavens and the earth were finished, done. Read the verse in context and look at the verse starting at Genesis 1:31 through 2:2, and look at the verb tense. It's all past tense. God said He's done creating. He's God. If He wants to set His own rule aside temporarily, like if they run out of wine at a wedding feast in Cana, He's perfectly capable of doing that. But as the world as a whole, it's done being created. The heavens and the earth are finished. But evolutionists think that everything is continuing on. We just have to learn how the processes are working. Finally, macroevolution versus microevolution. And this is a biggie. Our children have to understand this. Macroevolution is the idea that one type of organism can become a whole different type of organism. In other words, there's new genetic information available, and we get this type of organism becomes this type of organism. That's evolution with a big capital E. Okay? Or some people will call it the grand theory of evolution, GTE, you'll see in print. Microevolution is the idea there can be changes within a group, but all it's doing is sorting out existing genetic information. There can be changes, but those changes are limited. Now, what's the limit? Now, here we have to be careful. We will be accused by the evolutionists of believing in something called fixity of species. We do not believe in fixity of species, that a species can never change. We believe things can change, but there's a limit to how much it can change. God calls the limit a kind. He does not define it. In a biology classroom, sometimes a kind might be a species. Sometimes it might be a genus. Sometimes it might be a family. Sometimes it might be a phylum. We don't know. But there's a limit to how much things can change. Now, here's the important point. If I look at all these different things from one of my biology books, these are all the different types of dogs in this little chart. So this is dogdom, to coin a phrase. They're all considered one species, even by modern biology. Everything from a Chihuahua to a St. Bernard is Canis familiaris. There's a lot of variation in there. All these dogs are the same kind. Wolves and coyotes may be part of this same kind. Can we have variation within this? Sure, absolutely. Do you think there were two Chihuahuas, two Collies, two St. Bernards on the ark? Probably not. But there was enough genetic variability that over several generations, we can now define this set of traits and call that French poodle. But it's still dogs. Now, if you have a dog give birth to an octopus, that's macroevolution. See the difference? Now, where do our kids get brainwashed? Because if you ask an evolutionist for an example of macroevolution, they will give you microevolution every time. There's a few classics. Darwin. Darwin goes off on his voyage after going to seminary, I might add. So the problems with our seminaries didn't start recently. He went on a trip on a boat, and he goes to the Galapagos Islands. And he finds these finches. 14 varieties of finches, all in different parts of these different islands, all with different traits. And he comes up with this theory of the origin of species by natural selection. How many of you have read that book, by the way? Okay? We'll commiserate later. I prescribe it for people with insomnia. Okay? Darwin did not start the theory of evolution. What he did was he put it in a scientifically plausible package. And he described in great detail microevolution. And from that we have developed, this is how all organisms... Wait a minute. There's a tiny little point here. They're all finches. None of these finches evolved into bald eagles. I don't even know. Finches and bald eagles may be the same kind, but we didn't even see that. We're seeing differences in beak shape and the skin between the toes. Another classic, the peppered moth. There were black varieties, and there were speckled varieties. And when you put them on the trees, some stood out, and the birds could eat them, and some were camouflaged. And there was about 95% of them were camouflaged, and about 5% were dark black. The birds could pick them off and eat them. So that when you came and test it later, and the Industrial Revolution came along and covered all the trees in soot, then the black ones were now camouflaged, and the white ones stood out, and the birds could eat them. Guess what? It's in almost every evolutionary textbook. It's not even microevolution. Because there always were black, and there always were speckled. It's just the population shifted. A couple of things you're not supposed to know. Shh. When you go out the doors, don't tell people this, or they'll drum me out of the union. They cheat. They glued the moths down to the tree for the pictures. Because the birds that eat them fly around in the daytime. The moths fly around at nighttime. It's in almost every book. Resistance to antibiotics. You work in the drug industry. I heard that if we have all these new wonder germs that we can't kill them anymore. They've evolved a resistance. Ooh. No. We have this germ population, so we all in the room take penicillin, let's say. We kill all the germs that can be killed by penicillin. What's left to reproduce? The germs that can't be killed by penicillin, and then they reproduce and we all get sick again. They evolved. No. We killed all the ones that were killed by penicillin. They didn't reproduce. Simple rule of biology. Dead things rarely reproduce. I don't make up these rules. It's just the way it works. And you'll hear the same thing applied to pesticides, you know, wiping out, you know, insects, and now they're resistant. No, you killed all the ones that you kill with malathion, so now malathion doesn't kill them anymore. It's like if we passed a law that there were no redheads. We kill all the redheads. Realizing the red... By the way, who did I just offend? Anyway. Realizing that redhead is a recessive trait in biology class, after several generations, there would be no more redheads. Did the rest of us evolve? No, we weren't redheads to begin with. Horses. Love the horses. Okay? Now, when you look at this graph, this is very impressive looking. You see the horses getting bigger over time, and they have fewer toes. Now, that looks very convincing when it shows up in the How and Why Wonder Book of Evolution down in the local grocery store. But they're selecting data. A couple of things you should note, by the way. We see more variation in size in modern horses than in this picture. If you want to see tiny little horses that go around 38, 40 centimeters, you drive over to Pastor Al Harris's church, and then you jump over to Gettysburg, and you go to a little horse farm. So you're only about an hour and a half away. But you know what? The books usually don't tell you that if you counted the ribs, the little guy had 36, then it de-evolved into 30, but then it must have re-evolved 8 more ribs, but then it realized that's too much, and it de-evolved back to 36 again. See, when you line up the picture that way, it doesn't look nearly as impressive. How many of our kids in our Sunday schools could explain that? If one of their friends who saw that other picture in his science book at his school, how many of our kids could explain that to him? Who's going and talking to our kids and explaining this to them? Even evolutionists say this doesn't work. That gradual evolution of horses should be thrown out of the textbooks. Evolutionists admit that. They've had whole conferences about this. In one of the zoos in Tulsa, they took their whole horse exhibit out because all the people in the area rode into them and told them it was wrong. They had an entire convention in Chicago of evolutionists discussing, can we use microevolution as proof of macroevolution? The conclusion of the evolutionists was, no, we can't do that. And the bulk of our fundamentalist kids couldn't tell you the difference. We're left with two completely different thought patterns of how the world came to be. But we're generating students to turn over to the Christian schools. Oh, they'll fix it. Nah. No, we should start this way down in grade school. Explain this to them. We look at the world differently than the evolutionist does. You cannot reconcile the two areas of thought. And frankly, most of our students are not going to get attacked by their friends who are evolutionary thinking. They're going to get attacked by their friends who go to the local compromising church, who say, oh, well, just God used evolution as his way of creating. Oh, those days in Genesis, they're not literal days. Oh, by the way, I would not pound the pulpit for the number 24. Don't quote me out of context. I think the days in Genesis were probably shorter than modern days. See, an object, when it spins like a top, over time it does what? It slows down. So if currently it takes 24 hours, back when the world was created, it was probably spinning faster. 22, 21 hours, I don't know. I wouldn't pound the pulpit for the number 24. There's nothing magic there. So I always say literal solar day, one turn of the earth. Can our students defend that? See, again, we have numbers of people that go out and they have these big debates in the big halls and they invite all the evolutionary teachers in to debate. If you want to have a debate, don't call me. I'm not interested. That's intellectual combativeness. What I'm talking about is let's train our kids so they know what they believe and why they believe it. Our position that we take is that God said it, I believe it, that settles it. But I do have to admit, I was at a church where a lady said, older lady, probably in her mid-70s, said, Mr. Van, you really ought to change that slide. God said it, whether I believe it or not, that settles it. But can I suggest to you that if you look at the scientific evidence, the evidence really does support our way of thinking. Again, maybe you'd like to have the whole 12. You got a few weekends? We'll see what we can do. Again, thank you so much for allowing me to talk to you a little bit. Be thinking about how you can apply these things. Where in your Sunday school does it fit? Where in your Christian school does it fit? I would not, by the way, have in biology class have a creation unit. Because now you've just set up in your kids' minds, there's biology, and then there's the creation section. Now you intersperse it every day. Everything that comes up, you put that in. Here's why evolution won't work with this flower. Here's why this day-age theory won't work, because you can't have plants before the bumblebees to pollinate them. Oh, if it's a day, fine. If it's a billion years, it doesn't work. We've got to get this information to our kids and train them in the knowledge and the admonition of the Lord from the ground up. Again, I thank you for your patience. I know the last session in the day for a teacher is the worst time to be teaching. I will discuss with Dr. Harris the scheduling at another time. Sir.